This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. What's going on at the General Assembly? Well, we're into another week of the 2020 General Assembly session. Let's check with Andy Downs, who is the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, which is based at Purdue University Fort Wayne, for some of the latest. And as always, Andy, thank you for joining us on the program today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, bring us up to date here as we go into another week of the General Assembly session. Some action taken, some inaction taken, I suppose, as well, too. Bring us up to date.
Well, you know, when we look at a legislative session, we always start with the assumption that whatever we say we're going to be talking about at the start may not be what we're talking about at the end, because that's just the way the session goes.
Uh-huh.
At the start of this one, though, there were a lot of people saying this was going to be a relatively quiet session, nothing major happening, maybe even getting done early or earlier than they expected to get done. And for once, it seems to actually kind of be going that way. It's been a relatively quiet session. When we look to the governor's State of the State address, we saw a number of items come up that have or are being dealt with right away. But that was also a speech kind of previewing next year or next session in some ways when talking about things like teacher pay. So it's a session without a lot of, you know, really, really exciting or too confrontational things going on, but still one in which they managed to be moving a number of things very quickly.
I know there's a number of things that have come up already in committee. Some, of course, that have an impact on Northwest Indiana. There's been a Senate bill that has been at least heard from and will be heard from again soon. That would, in turn, affect public access to the Lake Michigan shoreline, in particular, beaches and places like Ogden Dunes and Long Beach and other communities like that. Are these measures that we see that have gone through committee are just going to basically get their first reading, so to speak, and maybe they'll sit and languish before they actually, if they even do come up before the regular House and the regular Senate?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and as a very quick reminder to people, every bill basically gets a first reading, and then it gets referred to committee, and if it doesn't move out of committee pretty quickly, then it's probably not going anywhere. This is a short session, and so we have deadlines coming up for bills to get, for example, their second reading and third reading, and for that matter, to be referred to the other chamber. At this point in the session, for things that have gone nowhere, they've just been referred to a committee, there's not been a committee meeting held or anything scheduled, for that particular bill, you can start to assume that that bill may be dead, but what we have to remember is in the second half of the session, when bills have moved from one chamber to the next, that's when bills start getting amended into other bills. And so for people who are interested in any particular topic, what they ought to be doing is looking for bills from the other chamber, or for that matter, bills from their own chamber that did have legs, that did get moved either to the other chamber or got maybe to second, third reading, because those are options for amending items in. And I encourage people to go to iga.in.gov, as in Indiana General Assembly, .indiana.gov. So iga.in.gov, and click on the legislation tab, and you can search that by subject. So you can look up things by sort of broad topics, and you can look them up much more specifically as well. So, for example, there might be some folks who are wondering if there's anything regarding LaPorte County or LaGrange County or Lake County, and sure enough, those are topics under the letter L in the subject heading.
I know in particular there are a number of bills that are like this that are very specific in their nature. One in particular we are keeping a very close eye on is a measure that's making through the Senate that hopefully will get to the House. If it's voted out by the Senate, is a measure that if it's approved would give the town of Griffith here in Lake County an opportunity to be able to set up its own township services, or also maybe another chance to join maybe a not quite non-contiguous county to be able to get out of Calumet Township, as they've been trying to do and they have the approval to do. Say they just have to find some other township to go to. Are we finding more measures like this, if they've gotten support in a committee, give them a little extra push when they go to the, in this case, the floor of the Senate?
You know, that's an interesting one, because it did come out of committee, obviously. Got its first readings referred to the Committee on Local Government, got out of the committee with actually a reassignment to tax and fiscal policy. And tax and fiscal policy has a very, very aggressive agenda for Tuesday, January 28th. And people may want to take a look at that, see how things are going there.
Yeah.
And that's as I recall, one that's on the agenda for Tuesday in fiscal policy. So really, people have to look for those sorts of movements. I wish the process were as simple as that old Schoolhouse Rock thing made it sound. but bills do kind of move around a little bit. This one, obviously heading over to tax and fiscal policy, getting a hearing tomorrow, or Tuesday, I should say, January 28th.
Yeah.
If I were someone up in that area, I would be somewhat optimistic because it was not simply referred to, but it was actually passed from one committee to another. So I would feel mildly optimistic, but at best cautious.
We're talking with Andy Downs with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne, about how the 2020 General Assembly session is going. There are always a number of interesting bills that come out. Some are very arcane in their nature. They specifically deal with a particular area. And there are other ones that just have interesting topics in particular. And I know there's a bill that is working its way, I think, still through the Senate. It's Senate Bill 291. It's a bill because if it got through without changes, although it doesn't seem like that's going to happen, something's going to change in that one. There are, I guess, some people that are not real happy about it. That would give Hoosier lawmakers who might be off duty and still the chance to be able to carry their handguns if they happen to be going to the casino. How did that pop up? I think it's probably scaring more people than anything.
Actually, what's been interesting is the way handgun legislation has been dealt with as far as legislators are concerned. So, for example, at times the state house has been a place where the average person cannot carry, but that legislators can. And of course, legislators who were opposed to that would always joke, I'm maybe more concerned about my colleagues having a handgun than somebody coming in off the street having a handgun. But it's not uncommon for there to end up being different rules for legislators and for the rest of us. And the easy one for people to think about is the fact that during the session, legislators really are immune from certain types of court action. And that's for a reason. It's because if they were not, then people might try to, for example, sue them right in the middle of a session in order to pressure them to take a vote on a particular issue. So it's not uncommon for legislators to get treated differently than you and me as average folks out here in the community. We'll see where this goes. You know, the idea of handguns and possession, licensure, et cetera, that's a very dynamic area right now in terms of what people are looking for. You know, there are folks who are pushing for lifetime licenses, but there are also people who are looking for different kinds of bans and restrictions placed on handguns. So this is really very much a give-and-take sort of topic at this time.
I know that you mentioned earlier, because and the governor's already said so, of course, that the issue of giving teachers raises or additional pay to be set aside for teachers and public schools in Indiana is going to be a matter that's going to have to come out in the next session because of the budget nature of it. Are there any measures that you're aware of that have the promise of making it through this particular session that are going to have a real impact this time?
Probably not. And what's interesting is since we do a two-year budget, it's not uncommon for elected officials to say, oh, well, we're not going to do anything that's fiscal in the year that's not the budget year.
Right.
And there's good reason for that, obviously. But at the same time, there are instances where they will go ahead and do something that is fiscal in nature, but they describe it not as opening up the entire budget. As a lot of people will recall, we have a fairly large surplus right now. And there are folks who said money in the surplus should immediately go to increase pay for teachers. There are others who point out we should not use one-time money for an ongoing expense. And by the way, this is not a budget year, so we shouldn't do that. The governor did foreshadow a bit here when he gave his State of the State address, and he said that he's going to request that a chunk of that surplus actually go to the pensions of the various school districts so that the school districts could divert funds from those pension expenses, into teacher salaries. The issue here is when that will be done, and the governor made it fairly clear. He did not mean this year. He meant next year as part of the overall budget negotiation. But immediately there were people who said, well, why can't we do that this year? If we're going to do that, why can't we do it this year instead of making teachers wait another 12 months for a raise?
Now, keeping an eye on this year with the General Assembly still in session, we know that once they finish up, many of the lawmakers are going to be back home in their districts, whether they're House or Senate districts, and are going to be campaigning for re-election. And many of them are going to be facing some opposition at the polls in the primary election coming up on May 5th. Do you think that it's still just a little early for them to start thinking politics, or are they going to have to wait till they get home?
For a lot of them, they're thinking politics all the time. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because if they're actually representing the people who elect them, then they should be thinking about what the public wants. And politics is nothing more than how we decide who gets what, when, and how. So they should be thinking about these things on an ongoing basis when they're casting votes. There are times when maybe because of the information they have, legislators have, they may want to do something that's contrary to public opinion, but it's because they maybe have more information or more complete information or are looking longer term. That's basically one way the system is supposed to work. But for a lot of the folks who are going to face those primary challenges, they very much are looking forward to a very smooth, short, almost boring short session here. And that may have been part of the reason that people were describing this in that way when they were looking at how this session was going to wrap up.
Well, Andy, thanks for taking time, spending it with us, looking at the General Assembly as it's in session right now, and a look a little ahead as well. Back with you again soon, I hope.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Downs, Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. Farmers across the Midwest are facing tight profit margins and rising health care costs, and that means that some are holding off getting the medical treatment or foregoing health insurance altogether. And as Side Effect Public Media's Samantha Horton tells us, some state farm bureaus are trying to help fill that gap.
Out on his family's farm in northern Indiana, Jacob Smoker does his evening chores feeding the cattle.
We raise beef cattle primarily. That goes to grocery stores, things like that, but then also we do row crops as well. Non-GMO corn, non-GMO soybeans, things for like tofu processing, as well as seed corn and wheat.
After working in Chicago, Smoker came back to the farm a few years ago and says one of the biggest challenges has been healthcare costs.
Each person in the operation kind of has their own way that they're doing healthcare. I've got a brother that's running without any right now. I've got some. My other brother runs with Department of Defense. He's a reservist in the Army.
And Smoker's wife is working in part to get health insurance for their family.
Myself, my wife teaches, and right now that's a really, really good benefit for our family. She doesn't do it for the money. It's mostly the insurance side of it.
Lots of Hoosier farmers face a similar problem, according to an Indiana Farm Bureau survey. At the group's annual convention in December, President Randy Crone told members that health care would be a top priority for 2020.
We had about 2,000 of you answered the survey. Two big things came out of it. One, it was very, very clear. Overwhelming majority said the health care cost was adversely affecting your farms, or the bottom line.
But Indiana law doesn't allow the Farm Bureau's proposed group health plan to cover sole proprietors. So the Bureau is looking to create that option, as Tennessee and several other Midwest states have done. Director of Public Policy Katrina Hall says there might be some pushback, but believes this is the best option to pursue. She says it will offer another option to the Affordable Care Act marketplace.
There may be some health insurance providers who feel like this is competition for them. I would point out, though, that aside from what's offered on the ACA exchange, the primary provider in Indiana does not offer individual policies.
However, these sorts of association health plans are raising concerns. Kevin Lucia of Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute says they can carry a risk. Healthy people might gravitate to these plans, leaving traditional plans to cover the most expensive care.
And the people in the traditional markets ultimately could face higher premiums over the long term. And that's an important risk to consider.
Lucia notes plans like the one the Indiana Farm Bureau wants to offer do not have to abide by the Affordable Care Act regulations. That may mean people with pre-existing conditions don't get covered, and there isn't robust mental health or maternity coverage.
So those are the kinds of things that I think state policymakers have to take into consideration.
Crone says the Farm Bureau plan will require a health evaluation, and that might cause some to be denied.
This isn't for everybody, but it will help a lot of our members. And I think it's another choice on the market that will help a lot of our members.
Back at the farm, Jacob Smoker realizes not every member of his family might be accepted into the group plan.
Every family's got some. My mom's got a heart condition that would probably exclude her from that.
But he still feels it's the best option, especially when it comes to younger generations taking over the family farm.
Folks like myself, young families, people that are coming back to the farms, it's hard enough to come back to an ag operation as it is. And if you can alleviate some of that burden through lessening the healthcare cost on an operator, that would be a huge benefit.
The Indiana Farm Bureau leadership hopes to start offering health plans for next year. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Samantha Horton.
And the Farm Bureau, by the way, a bill is going to be scheduled for a hearing with the General Assembly tomorrow. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation. Last week, we talked to one of my colleagues, Dr. James Arendis. He is the Director of the Construction Safety Institute at the Construction Advancement Foundation. And we ran out of time, but he's back in studio to join us again. Doctor, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, Kevin. Glad to be here.
So how does Indiana compare, say, with the rest of the country as far as their safety rates on a whole? Do you have any kind of studies that have been done that show how our region, because our region is heavily unionized, and I mean, from what I can see, we have like one of the better safety programs in the country. And I mean, is there any studies that have shown, you know, how does our rate compare to rates in throughout the nation?
I do belong to a number of different organizations that are national, and it's pretty clear that in Northwest Indiana, because of the experience of our workers and our contractors and the unions, we're probably in that range of being the best in the country. Now, to give it some perspective, the Northwest Indiana Business Roundtable is a organization that is the actual members of it are our industrial users, you know, the steel mills, refineries, power plants, and more. Universities are even involved in that now, and the hospitals. So they have an annual program where they have an awards banquet. It's a really big event. There's 600-700 people attend this. And the contractors submit all of their data, which would be very similar to that process I discussed earlier with assessing the contractors. So we get all the statistics. The Business Roundtable gets all these statistics, and they do an analysis of it. And a couple years ago, we thought about it and decided to go beyond just collecting this data, that we would actually grind it down and come up with some numbers. And the Business Roundtable actually, and I sit on that committee also, but I'm just a minor player, and you know, it's a big group of industrial users and contractors participating. And we actually took the data and ground it down and made a comparison to the national average for safety in the country. And Northwest Indiana is 14.8 times safer than the countries across, or the companies that do construction work across the country. So the Business Roundtable has a little bit to brag about in that department, and they have a safety committee there where the contractors and the owners get together and work out problems, you know, provide training and education, and essentially brainstorm different ways of improving the safety outcomes in Northwest Indiana.
So I talk to a lot of students about careers in the construction industry, and one thing that's kind of overlooked sometimes is careers in safety. And I know there's a lot of careers out there that exist in safety. Can you talk maybe a little bit about your career path, how you got involved in safety, and how you have come to work for the Construction Advancement Foundation?
Yes. My education is in environmental safety management. Indiana State University had a degree in it, actually going back into the 70s, early 70s. I think they might even start a little bit before that. I developed an interest in it, did some labor work in the steel mills when I just came out of high school. And I saw how important the safety was there. Met some of the safety people there when I was doing labor work. And later on, I saw that as an opportunity to maybe get a degree in that. And there really wasn't that many degrees around the country, only a few universities that had it. So that's what drew me into it. Now it is certainly a huge occupation. A lot of universities doing around the country. And there's, compared to when I started in this, there's a lot of jobs all across the country. Like a construction contractor, a large one, might have a safety person for the whole company. And now some of the larger, especially on the industrial side, they've got 25, 30, some of them up to 100 safety people on their staff. Some of them are, you know, doing the corporate side of, you know, maintaining programs and, you know, having a bigger view of it. And it goes down to folks that are in the field that are doing site safety work. So it's become a really huge occupation. Now, in Northwest Indiana, we're fortunate because there's a degree program through Purdue, Northwest here in the main campus that does that degree is the Hammond campus. And the person that runs that is Dr. Shoji Nakayama. And they are pumping out students with this degree. And Shoji cannot keep up with the requests from industry for his people. He cannot produce enough students to actually fill the positions that exist in our area here in Northwest Indiana. So, yeah, then, you know, for myself, when I first came out of college, I went straight to work for OSHA in Chicago with the federal government. And I stayed there for a number of years. In the time I was doing that, Purdue had a few safety classes, and actually I started teaching at Purdue. It was Purdue Calumet at the time. I was actually 22 years old when I first started teaching there. I've had, you know, some jobs with contractors, the opportunities in this are huge. For me, this was, you know, working for the foundation, I'm solving problems for 550 contractors here in Northwest Indiana. When I worked for one contractor, I was just solving their problems. So this was a bigger challenge for me. And when this opportunity came up, I was really excited about working for the Construction Advancement Foundation. And it actually turned out to be even a better opportunity than I thought. You know, this is my 22nd year working there. And it's a great organization. We've got great contractors, and it's really enjoyable to work with our customers also, you know, throughout our industry here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, that was a lot of great information, Doctor. I appreciate you joining us today.
Anytime, Kevin.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana. I would like to thank our guest, Dr. James Arendis. He is the director of the Construction Safety Institute at the Construction Advancement Foundation. To find out more information about the Construction Safety Institute, you can visit cafnwin.org.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation, and you can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Tuesday, and the podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
It didn't take a lot of, let's sit down and have a Ward Cleaver moment with Beaver, you know, and tell him what's going on in our neighborhood. We didn't need that. I mean, we were all kind of wise and hip to what's going on. We knew it. So we left in 1979, I'm guessing, for Portage, and I kept going to school in Gary. I drove my motorcycle into Gary every day, which in hindsight, I'm thinking, what am I doing? But I didn't think twice about it. I proudly rode my motorcycle from Portage to Gary every day to go to school, that kind of thing. I was part of the white flight. I would love to go back and interview my parents, what they thought, especially my dad. What was he thinking? He passed away almost 30 years ago. But I would love to ask him those questions. Did you want to take a stand? Did you want to stay there and go, we're going to stay here and, you know, we're going to hold this off, and we're going to be fine, and we're going to show people everything's going to be fine here, that kind of stuff? Or was it just an inevitability that washed over him and go, man, we just can't stay any longer. I'm tired of either locking my doors three times or worrying about my daughter or my kids. There was a specific rape that I remember and a murder. Her name was Brenda Banaski. And if you say, I think that name, and I think I have her name right, if you say that name to anybody who lived in Miller back then, they'd go, oh yeah, Brenda Banaski. It was a bell for everyone, especially about the white community. Like, oh man, this is not the same. We're not the same anymore. And then other crimes happening just in our neighborhood, and double locking and triple locking doors, you know, which I do. You know, I would lock the door of this office right now if you let me. Who knows? Click. You never know. That's part of the upbringing. We were never vandalized or criminalized, our family, I don't think, in Gary, that I can recall. So I don't think it was one specific traumatic event that did it. I think it was just an accumulative effect around us. So it wasn't anything personal to us. And matter of fact, after we left Gary, moved to Portage, I remember my dad's car that he loved, it was called a Riviera, I think it was. It got stolen in Portage, and I thought that was the funniest thing. We moved to Portage, and we lose our car already. What the hell are we doing? Moving to Portage. Should have stayed in Gary, much safer there. But I have mixed feelings. Well, kind of like shame of being just another white family that fled a urban city, so to speak, like so many thousands, tens of thousands of others. But we didn't do it like out of, I think, anger. A lot of people who were raised, especially in the 40s and 50s, and they think that was their golden moment in life, and the city of Gary was a magical industrial miracle city, they were mad, angry, and they're still mad. I've written the book called Lost Gary, and I've talked to people at presentations, and they're still mad. Decades later, they were kicked out. They were forced to leave their city, is how they view it. I don't think we had that. Our family did not have that kind of anger and animosity. We just kind of did the smartest thing. We're just, you know, surviving middle-class existence. It wasn't a big thought process. It's like, my daughter can be endangered here. My kids can get better education elsewhere. We're going to move on. I'm closer to work. They worked in the Bethlehem Steel at the time, so it was even a closer commute for them. Everything just seemed like green light to go out of town.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The General Assembly has been taking up a number of measures in a number of different topics this session, and we have a latest on how the environmental bills are shaping up. In fact, there's one in particular we'll find out more about because it's sponsored and supported by folks from Northwest Indiana. Dr. Indra Frank, who is the Environmental Health and Water Policy Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council, is with us to talk about the legislation that's underway. And Dr. Frank, thank you for joining us on the program today. If you will, fill us in on some of the measures that have come out of session, at least out of committee, maybe we should say. They haven't all gone through up to four final votes and the like. One in particular we're curious about, and that you can tell us more about, is Senate Bill 214. That's one that is was created and has been sponsored by legislators here in Lake County.
So Senate Bill 214 would help reduce children's exposure to lead. It was written by Senators Randolph and Niemeyer, who are from Lake County, and they were joined by Senator Stoops from Bloomington on that one.
Well, reducing
kids' exposure is a good thing.
I understand that in this case, and having had a chance to talk before the session began this year with Senator Randolph, he was mentioning about the fact that he has in the past pushed for and has gotten support for specific measures for school districts in Indiana and Lake County in particular, and in turn, but he's been more concerned about making it more countywide. First, tell us, the general problems that lead can pose in not only adults, but especially in young children.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So lead is toxic to the nervous system, but especially for young children. While their brains are developing, if they're exposed to lead, it can reduce their intelligence, and it can put them at higher risk for behavior problems. So, yeah, we definitely want to make sure that our kids aren't exposed to lead. There's three main ways that young children or pregnant women can get exposed to lead. One is lead dust. When there's been lead paint on the wall but it's old and it's deteriorating, that can put lead into the house dust. Or lead in contaminated soil. Or lead in drinking water. Now, the lead in drinking water doesn't get there from, you know, your public utility. The lead leaving a drinking water treatment plant is clean, but it can pick up lead as it moves through pipes or fixtures that have lead in them. And it turns out lead wasn't banned from our plumbing until, just in the last 20 years or so. So older buildings are at risk for having lead pipes or lead fixtures, and that's how lead can get into drinking water.
I know in particular we have communities, for example, in Hammond, in East Chicago, in Gary, that have school buildings are that older or even older in some cases. So there's even more of a risk, I suppose, if those buildings haven't been had their plumbing replaced or at least refitted to be able to get rid of the potential for lead.
That's right. Right. And so what this bill, Senate Bill 214, would do is require schools to check during just take samples of water from each of the taps or drinking water fountains and see if that plumbing fixture is putting any lead into the water. Right now, the bill applies just to Lake County, and that's because the authors have explained that county has had a long industrial history, and they need to reduce children's exposure there perhaps more urgently because there are other sources of lead from the county's history. But there are efforts to make this a policy statewide. And as you said, the legislative session isn't over yet, so we are still hopeful that this could be a policy statewide. And there are school buildings old enough to have lead plumbing fixtures all around the state.
Now, you mentioned that the matters come up in committee. In fact, the Senate Environmental Affairs Committee passed it along yesterday, so it's, I guess, going now to the full Senate to be considered and the potential for a vote from them, of course, and, of course, then it would go over to the House. Or is there a companion bill that might be along those same lines that's over in the House right now? Or are they going to wait for the Senate bill that Senator Randolph put out?
You know, as a matter of fact, there is a similar bill on the House side.
Mm-hmm.
House Bill 1265 by Representative Jackson, Carolyn Jackson, who is also from Lake County. Her bill is also moving. It made it out of committee, and it's up for a second reading today. We understand that there's going to be an amendment introduced this afternoon to convert her bill from Lake County only to statewide. So we would have... That would mean that we'd be checking our schools statewide to make sure that the drinking water there is safe for the kids.
One other measure that we know that has gone through, at least in committee, another Senate bill, it's gone through the Senate Environmental Affairs Committee involving the environment, is one that deals with, I guess what's best described as carbon sequestration. It's a very long mm-hmm. term, but tell us what carbon sequestration is all about and what this measure that has been already put through and has gone through the committee is going to try to accomplish during the session.
Sure. So this is Senate Bill 368, authored by Senator Stoops, along with Senators Glick and Lysing. What it does is ask the Legislative Council to create a summer study of the issue of carbon sequestration. So carbon sequestration means measures like planting trees or farming practices that put organic matter into the soil. Those practices help draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And as I'm sure you know, most of your listeners have heard, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It's contributing to climate change. So measures like planting trees and carbon farming or farming practices that put organic matter into the soil, that reduces the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere and can help with our climate change issues. So this bill would study that issue and study ways that Indiana might, solutions Indiana might have for our forests and our farms that would help with the problem.
Have most of the lawmakers that are supporting this particular bill, the measure that's made it out of committee, are they in districts in we'll say, the southern half of Indiana, south of Indianapolis in particular, closer to the Ohio River, where we know there's a lot of forest areas down there?
You know, that's true. But, Senator Glick is from the northern part of the state, and Senator Lysing actually is closer to the Hoosier National Forest. Mm-hmm. And then Senator Stoops, the third author on the bill, is from the Bloomington area. And, of course, that's right near the Hoosier National Forest.
Right. So not all of the sponsors of the measure or supporters of the measure are in the Hoosier National Forest or the forestry areas of mm-hmm. southern Indiana. They may be just in rural areas that have an abundance of trees, and they have to keep that in mind too when they probably bring the topic up.
Oh right, yeah, but there has been interest in the agricultural professionals as well
mm-hmm.
that this might. Help put funding into the farmers' hands to help them use those practices that build organic matter in the soil. It's better for the soil, it's better for farming, but it also helps draw down the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere if we're putting organic matter into the soil. So both through trees and through, organic matter in the soil, we can actually have an impact on the greenhouse gases.
Dr. Frank, we only have about a minute or so left here. Bring us up to date if there's some other measures that are still making their way through the legislative process that deal with the environment, and in particular with environmental health. Are there any others out there that we should keep an eye on?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's another one I'd like to mention that is also from a representative up north. This is Representative Boy is working with Representative Hatfield on House Bill 1337. It would require any entity that has a chemical spill to report that to nearby drinking water utilities.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, Representative Boy, by the way, is from Michigan City, but she is, along with many others, that are very concerned with all the problems that we've had on Lake Michigan, in the Portage area in particular, with the ArcelorMittal, and even from U.S. Steel, from the plants along the lakefront that have somehow gotten some discharges into the water. Yeah.
That's right.
So, well, keep a close eye on that one, if you will, and keep us updated, if you will, on that measure in particular. We want to find out more and be able to pass the word along, too. And we thank you for spending time with us to talk about these measures that have gotten out of Senate committee and are working their way through the Senate and their companion bills in the House. Thanks for being with us today to talk about it.
Oh, I'm very glad to talk with you. I'm glad you're on the topic.
Dr. Indra Frank is the Environmental Health and Water Policy Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. More and more Americans are living without health insurance, and that's forcing some to have to search far away for health care, even across state lines. Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez-Vandivia is going to report now on a free clinic that is pushing for a referendum to expand Medicaid in Missouri.
He's waiting on a bench outside a converted rectory.
Come get a tooth check and see what they got to do to it. Maybe get them all out.
The 56-year-old works in northern Arkansas and drove an hour and a half to the Good Samaritan Care Clinic. Trucks hauling timber out of the Ozarks fly by on Route 60, which runs right through the town of 2700. The clinic sits next to the First Baptist Church, which donated the building. It's open once a week, and, the big draw for Cox, it's free.
A big relief, yeah, compared to a big bill, you know, which I got a lot of them, but it's hard, and it's good to know, and thank God that they got places like this, you know, because it helps out the poor people, you know, it really does.
Cox is not alone. Around 5 p.m., the door opens and dozens of patients file into the waiting room where they're given forms to fill out before treatment starts at 7. The clinic will see everyone who's in the waiting room at that time, usually from 35 to 50 patients.
We see a lot of middle age men and women who have gone without care for a long time.
Sherry Noble is the clinic's administrator and only full-time staffer. She coordinates volunteers, often doctors and nurses, who drive some 100 miles from Springfield after working full days at their own practices. Noble says they've seen a rising number of patients over the last couple of years. That coincides with another troubling trend. In 2018, more than 27 million Americans went without insurance for the entire year, the Census Bureau says. That was an increase of almost 2 million from the year before. Experts point to a number of factors, including President Trump's moves to undermine the Affordable Care Act. Medicaid restrictions are a factor as well.
We see that states are putting more red tape on families who are trying to enroll their children in Medicaid or making it harder for them to renew and extend their Medicaid coverage.
Joan Alker heads the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. It says Missouri has seen one of the biggest increases in uninsured children in the country. The state is one of 14 that haven't expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
If Missouri were to expand Medicaid to parents and other adults, you'd see a welcome mat effect for the children, and that uninsured rate would come down.
Alker says free clinics like the one in Mountain View can be stopgaps for families without insurance, but they're not a sustainable resource for children. Dr. John Roberts, who founded the clinic 15 years ago, agrees.
In an ideal world, we'd be put out of business, truly, you know, that there would be a health plan for everybody.
That's why he supports an initiative to get Medicaid expansion on the ballot in Missouri. The Republican-run legislature has rejected expansion there, but ballot initiatives have succeeded in other GOP-controlled states like Idaho and Utah.
For people to sign who are registered voters.
Outside the clinic, a volunteer collects signatures to get the issue in front of voters in 2020. If the initiative succeeds, an estimated 200,000 people could be eligible for medical insurance. For Roberts, that could mean fewer patients at his clinic, something he welcomes.
They wouldn't have to wait in line for 3 or 4 hours on a Monday night in the heat of the summer and the cold of the winter of hoping that there will be seen.
Missouri Healthcare for All announced in September it had gathered 25% of the 172,000 signatures it needs. The deadline is May 3rd. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
Purdue University Northwest School of Engineering is expanding and is deepening its connections with local and regional business and industry in some new and novel ways. One of them is a faculty internship program. And we asked the director of the school, Professor Dietmar Remfer, to join us on Regionally Speaking to talk about how the idea came about here in Northwest Indiana.
This is a program that was developed at the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. Ultimately, it went back to ideas that I had that I discussed with my external advisory board. I have a number of industry representatives in this external advisory board from local and regional industries. We have a lot of support from NIPSCO, NiSource. We have the steel industry. ArcelorMittal is involved there. And so together with those representatives, I brought up this idea at one of the external advisory board meetings, and we developed it from there.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea which faculty members are most likely to be interested in becoming interns in this way, and also to what they may certainly be involved in if they pick a business or an industry out there, as I know that you're starting to have now with your very first intern out there.
So this is a program for all faculty in the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. And maybe going a little bit back to the background that this is built upon. Mm-hmm. One of the core ideas behind what we're doing with the School of Engineering, and going even further back, the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest is a very new school. It was founded in the summer of 2017. I was hired as the founding director of the School of Engineering. We had two engineering departments before. We have a department of mechanical and civil engineering and a department of electrical and computer engineering. But then university leadership decided that we wanted to raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest as a Purdue institution. Clearly, engineering should be one of the signature programs at the university. And so then the question is, how do we go about doing this? How do we raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest and, frankly, in Northwest Indiana? And one of the things that are important to me personally as well is that a university and a school of engineering, they need to be embedded in the fabric of the region that is hosting them. So we want to build two-way relationships between the university, in my case, and of course, with the School of Engineering and the surrounding community of industry, innovators, communities, startup entrepreneurs, and all of these people. So the question is, how do we create these deeper connections? And so this faculty internship is one way to do this. Mm-hmm. The idea is that on the one hand, we allow our stakeholders, entrepreneurs, people in industry, communities, to take advantage of the expertise that our faculty have. So if they have projects that they would like to have some help on, then we can make faculty expertise available to them. So this way we can help our surrounding community with the expertise that our faculty have. And on the other hand, our faculty have the opportunity to learn about new approaches, to learn about the current problems that industry is dealing with, and then to bring this knowledge back to the classroom so that they can train our students better, so that they stay up to date, and ultimately our students will be able to hit the ground running when they go back to industry.
Do you think that this is an opportunity that I know Purdue University, all of the campuses are very strong on, is experiential learning? Yeah. Be able to get the student really ready for life outside of the ivy walls, so to speak, and being ready to go out there in that profession that they would like to take on with their degree.
Yes, exactly. So experiential learning in all engineering schools across the nation, that is something that has become very important. If we go back in history a little bit, if you look at the way engineering schools were run in the 1950s, It turned out that actually the majority of faculty were people coming out of industry. They were practitioners. So the education of engineering graduates was very practically oriented. But then people realized that in order to have graduates that are ready for unknown challenges, for new technologies that are coming up, remember we were starting to think about going to the moon, there was this idea that our engineering graduates should be stronger on fundamentals. And this was the start of what was called the beginning of engineering science and the engineering scientist. And as a consequence, engineering departments became much more focused on hiring faculty that were scientists, that did research. And the education of engineers, certainly in four-year programs and beyond, became much more theoretical, which had all sorts of benefits. This was a good thing. So, as you know, we went to the moon and we developed all these new technologies. But there was a downside as well in that the education became less practical, and industry started to notice that they needed to spend a significant amount of effort to take these graduates coming from engineering schools and make them ready to work and be productive for their enterprises. And so obviously time scales are relatively long. Things move slowly in academia sometimes. What happened then was there was more and more an emphasis on practical education. There is a central accrediting agency for engineering education, ABET, which then required all students to have what we call a capstone design experience. So this meant that practice-based learning and experiential learning became more important in engineering education. So fast forward to where we are now, all engineering schools that are accredited by ABET, meaning all engineering schools basically, have practice-based learning as part of their curriculum. So with this faculty internship, we're expanding the range of these things to not only have practice-based learning for our students, if you will, but also have practice-based learning and keep our faculty up to date with practice in industry.
Professor Remfer says that more faculty members involved in the program at Purdue University Northwest seem to be interested in the internship program. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. On tomorrow's program, we'll give you more information about an initiative that's being set out by the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance and the Northern Indiana Passenger Rail Association to try to get more help from lawmakers on the issue of passenger rail in the Hoosier State. And also a conversation with the noted Indiana economist, writer, and speaker, Morton Marcus. And we hope you can join us for the program tomorrow.